Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a new moss in town, technically in a meadow in northeastern Wisconsin. We'll talk to a researcher who found the rare plant here in the state and find out why moss matters. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about an Army veteran who's turned to forestry and writing in Wisconsin's North Woods.
Brian Box served two tours in the United States Army in Afghanistan. Now he works in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods. In 2019, Box wrote the essay Ghosts of War in a Wisconsin Forest for the New Republic, depicting his struggles with PTSD and the healing potential of the North Woods. I recently went to visit Box. We walked through the woods, recorded his essay, and talked about why he wrote it. A warning for listeners, the following contains descriptions of violence and self-harm.
Every day I start the shift by throwing on my marking gear. It's not as heavy as my kit in Afghanistan, just an easy 40-odd pounds with the paint. Instead of a blaze orange cruiser vest like the ones my coworkers use, I still take the old tactical vest I wore over my armor back then. See, when I first got in, I was with 1st Squadron, 4th Cavalry Regiment into eastern Afghanistan. And about a month before I was supposed to get out of the Army, they said, hey, needs of the Army, you got to stay. And I did another 16 months in the Army, and that time I was the operations assistant, so I was running the Troop Operations Center. And yeah, I had the record in the squadron for the fastest medevac ever done, 11 minutes and 56 seconds from the time of the IED strike to the when the wheels went up and our guys were on their way to the medical center. So it's kind of crazy. You know, my first deployment, I was spending a lot of time shooting at people. And then my second deployment, my primary focus was getting all my guys home. I don't like taking life. I don't like suffering. You know, so that first deployment was kind of a wreck for me. And then the second one, I did my best to prevent that.
When he got home, Box took a job in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods. And that's where the idea for the essay came to him.
I was working out on this timber sale that we're sitting in right now. And I was alone. I was working 60 hours a week alone, and I was having nonstop flashbacks. Thunderstorm passed through today, dropping walnut-sized hail and blowing trees down around me. I hid under a big sugar maple, and as trees dropped all around me, I realized that I couldn't remember precisely how many friends wound up in flag-draped coffins, but that more had died by suicide than from enemy action. I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, maybe I should put this pen to paper, at least to try and excise whatever demon I was dealing with out there. When Dave and Adrian died instead of me, my commander and gunner killed by an IED, I blamed myself for years. I don't know, that was my albatross for a long time. It's kind of drove me nuts there for a while. It took me a couple of years to recover after I got out of the Army, just from that high intensity, like constant paranoia. But
now, out in the forest, Box says he contends with post-traumatic stress on a regular basis.
Sometimes when I'm marking timber, I'll have a flashback and just stand there, staring off into space for God knows how long. I don't know if my coworkers have noticed. I tried to show people what it was like to just have that running in your head all the time. Like, that's what PTS feels like. You know, and that piece was a bit cathartic. You know, I actually slept pretty darn well after that.
Box was also approved through the VA for an emotional support animal. His dog, Elias, is his constant companion.
Elias is like, he's been a lifesaver, and he keeps me focused on the present. Like when he's doing his 100-meter circle and he's happily doing his thing and rolling in wolf scat, much to my dismay, he helps me so much. Sometimes when I'm out marking alone, I'll catch something out of the corner of my eye, get the sneaking feeling I'm being watched. Often I'll find it's a deer, a bear, or if I'm really lucky, one of our wolves. But Sometimes I don't find anything, just left with a feeling of a presence. I wonder whether it's my brain injury doing something sparky, but I'd like to imagine the entity as one of my dead friends come to walk with me under the emerald canopy.
Box has served his country in combat, but he still feels he owes a debt. And he says helping Wisconsin's North Woods to survive and thrive is how he can repay.
When I was a kid, we didn't have enough food to eat. And a USDA program to feed inner city kids when the summer break was happening, that was sometimes the only meal I got that day. And the veterans programs that my mom had access to, she was a disabled vet in the Coast Guard. She got really badly injured on a rescue mission. Those programs that the American people offered to both me and my family kept me from starving. They economically empowered my mom to go and get a degree in electrical engineering, to be a successful postal worker, and have a decent life. That's a debt that I'll never be able to repay. But I'm doing my best, you know? And if I can help the Northwoods sequester more carbon, I think that will be my contribution. I'll take that as an epitaph. I love this forest. Doing good forestry is like being the pen and writing a love letter to the forest. Fate, I have learned, is a haphazard forester, marking clumps for destruction, then cutting unevenly, leaving some stems behind, vulnerable to rot. But under the right conditions, the stumps can sprout anew, and the hollowed out stems that remain can find new purpose.
Brian Box is a veteran of the United States Army and works in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods. His essay, Ghosts of War in a Wisconsin Forest, was originally published in the New Republic. A full audio version can be heard on our website at wisconsinlife.org. If you or someone you know might need help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 at 1-800-273-8255. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, a moss enthusiast and UW-Green Bay professor tells us about the school's plant museum and a moss variety he and some volunteers came across that was previously uncatalogued here in the state. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, in this off-election year, anxiety over schools fired up voters around the country. How might those fears factor into who controls Congress this time next year? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a quote to start things off. There will always be something new to discover. A minute moss never found before. A rabbit eating birdseed with the boars on a hungry November day. A bittern that stays only long enough to be remembered. Those words came from the late naturalist and author Ann Zwinger. And our next guest actually lived part of that, the moss part. Keir Wefferling is an assistant professor and curator of the Fewless Herbarium in UW-Green Bay's Cofran Center of Biodiversity. He, along with volunteers, recently came across a moss that he'd never seen before and that's never been documented scientifically in Wisconsin before. Keir is with us now to talk more about the experience and the herbarium. Keir, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Set the scene for us first, Keir. Tell us about this field trip you and the volunteers were out on.
All right. So this was late September, and we had our rubber boots on and hand lenses and some collecting bags. And this was up in the Northeast Sands region of Wisconsin, up in Oconto County. And it was a state natural. It is a state natural area. And we were just doing a preliminary survey of the bryophytes, the mosses and liverworts and hornworts that exist there, and set out through kind of a white cedar swamp. A very wet forest with a huckleberry understory and conifer overstory, and then lots of beautiful ferns and fern allies and hummocks of mosses, at least five different species of sphagnum moss in the understory. And we were doing what we call a meander survey, which you know, it implies we don't know where we're going. And in that, in this case, that was true. We were just sort of wandering toward the lake. And we expected to find a pretty rich bryophyte community, a rich moss community, just based on the geologic and glacial history of the of this this part of Wisconsin. And there was a pretty rapid transition when we reached the edge of the lake. We stepped out onto this sort of quaking floating mat over a shallow lake, and encountered a very different moss community and a bunch of ericads, a bunch of blueberry relatives like cranberry and some leatherleaf and some Labrador tea, and a few insectivorous or carnivorous plants. Now some rare orchids and sedges, and then we crossed this little inlet to the lake. It was a treacherous crossing. We only had, you know, our 12-inch rubber boots on and hoping not to go over the tops. And so I was out there with Joan Berkopek and Ron Eichhorn, and Joan and I have been collaborating on learning the mosses of the region just over the last few months to a year. And we were hunched over right by this inlet, and we were on opposite sides of a little clump of sedge, and both of us were exclaiming, look at this, check this out. And neither of us wanted to look at what the other was looking at, because what we were looking at was so cool. And I was starting to exclaim some you know, pretty colorful language, and because it was just such a strange looking little moss, but I didn't know what it was when I first saw it, nor did Joan. And turned out to be this little tufted fen moss, this beautiful little you know, diminutive plant. The tufted fen moss, as you correctly stated, it has not been found or documented in like a Western scientific framework before in Wisconsin. As far as I know, the people that were here before us and who are still here, Menominee and Ocheti Sakawin and Anishinaabeg, these First Nations people, they very likely had a relationship with the plant, know about the plant. I've reached out, and I'm in communication with some colleagues in UW Green Bay's First Nations Studies program to learn more about these mosses and other plants and what they might tell us about the communities that we're in.
And Kier, you know, stepping back a little bit, I think we might assume that scientists have already found all the stuff, all the species that are in a place, things like that. No, there's still some sense of, as you said, not really discovery exactly, because people probably knew about it hundreds of years ago, but a sense of finding something that at least our current scientific community didn't know was out there.
Yeah, it's super exciting. I think it definitely points to the fact that we don't know everything that's out there, and there's so much to learn. And I think getting people, you know, out to these special areas to look more closely at these communities is important. Building these collaborations and looking with in some cases new eyes.
As you mentioned, you have this effort to catalog moss. You are into moss lately. Give us a little quick moss 101. What is it? What does it do in an ecosystem?
Yeah, so mosses in the peatlands, these peat accumulating wetlands, where I've been really interested in spending more time in lately. So a peat accumulation occurs when production or fixation of carbon from the atmosphere outpaces decomposition, and that state of peat accumulation can occur in really acidic environments or really basic high alkaline high pH environments. This tufted fen moss was found in the latter, a boreal rich fen. So that's a mineral rich, nutrient rich, alkaline environment or plant community. Some of these acidic plant communities, like the bogs and the muskegs, the mosses are ecosystem engineers. They'll actually acidify their surroundings and sort of lay the stage for these other acid-loving vascular plants, the flowering and seed plants. So these mosses can be ecosystem engineers. They can be, in many cases, very sensitive to the abiotic conditions, the groundwater quality and quantity and temperature, water fluctuation regimes, and so forth. So they can tell us something, they can tell us a lot simply by their presence about the conditions of a site. And I'm interested in sort of, you know, using these mosses in that framework as indicator species to tell us about these natural plant communities where we want to spend time and study and preserve and conserve, and they can really inform our understanding of the dynamics as our climate changes and as we impact our land more and more.
Talking to Kira Wefferling, assistant professor and curator of the Fewless Herbarium at UW Green Bay's Cofran Center of Biodiversity, looking at the finding of a previously uncatalogued moss species here in Wisconsin. And something that struck me, Kira, in your description of where you found the moss, I will admit, I'm not a guy who's good at identifying plants. I walk through the woods and I can pick a tree, grass, flower, sure, that kind of thing, moss maybe.
Yeah.
But the incredible amount of diversity you just described in a very small area, for those who know what they're looking for, can you talk about how much variety we can find in just maybe a few square yards in some places in the state?
I don't have a really tidy answer for that, I'm afraid. Yeah, a few square yards. We might see dozens of moss species, fewer vascular plant species. So it all depends on the community that you're looking for, right? There's also the liverworts, another bryophyte, another non-vascular land plant. These are plants that reproduce by spore and sometimes asexual propagules. They'll just sort of break apart, or they'll have specialized reproductive structures that are not necessarily due to sexual reproduction, and we're looking at the gametophyte stage in the mosses. They're haploid dominant, so they just have a single genome copy that governs, you know, how they interact with their environment. And the sporophyte, what I think we're used to interacting with, like when we look at a tree, that's the sporophyte generation, the diploid usually generation. In the case of the mosses and in the liverworts, the sporophyte's actually parasitic, essentially, on the gametophyte. It's growing out of and supported by the gametophyte. It's got a wonderful little life cycle. Spore reproduction, and these spores, they can just disperse very long distances. So, I've been asked, in this case, the tufted fen moss, whether it might have just come here from somewhere else recently, and that's perfectly plausible. In this case, the tufted fen moss is actually single sex, so individuals will be either male or female. So that's a problem with dispersal. If you only get one sex, then you won't get reproductive. You won't get sexual reproduction after that initial colonization event.
Now, speaking of lots of plant diversity here, I don't want to run out of time without talking about the herbarium at UW Green Bay. Can you talk about this, in effect, library of plants?
Yeah, great. The herbarium is basically a museum. It's a collection of dried, pressed plant specimens. The Fewless Herbarium has about 45,000 dried vascular plant specimens, and I'm trying to add mosses to that. And there are like 13 other, as far as I can count, 13 other herbaria here in Wisconsin, about 3,000 in the world, and we're one of them. So we're, you know, storing these plants, and they're used for biodiversity studies. So they can inform phenology, geographic distribution, morphology, even in some cases, one can get molecular data from herbarium specimens, actually break off a piece of leaf and grind it up, get the DNA and sequence that DNA. I'm working on digitizing the collection, meaning taking high resolution photographs of every specimen and I'm putting that on a public facing portal. So that, I think that's really exciting. A lot of herbaria are doing that these days and really adds to the value.
And yeah, when can the public start getting a look at that digitized collection? So maybe people like me are better at spotting those plants out in the wild.
Sure. I don't know. Hopefully within a year or two. It's going to take quite a bit of time to get through our collection. And I'm still in the process of setting up that infrastructure. But I have really good support from the Cochrane Center for Biodiversity and from the university as well. So hoping sooner than later, but we'll see.
In just our last few moments, do you have more moss expeditions in the works now?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's, convenient or wonderful about mosses is that in many cases they're evergreen and you can visit them any time of the year as long as there's not snow on the ground. So I'm heading back out to some boreal-rich fens actually next Thursday. So up in Door County, I'm looking for a few more mosses before the winter time.
Well, happy exploring, Kira. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Kira Wefferling is assistant professor and curator of the Fewless Herbarium at UW-Green Bay's Cochrane Center of Biodiversity. Talked to him about a moss he recently identified that had not previously been documented in the state. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it can be good to be connected to people, but maybe social media makes us too connected for our brains to handle. A guest makes the case for a slower social network. Plus, we'll check out an effort to provide more dental care to people in Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, political watchers say education played a big role in the Virginia governor's race, but a widely watched school board recall focusing on similar issues in Wisconsin fell short. We'll take a closer look at the increasing role of education in elections. First, a federal judge says former President Donald Trump can't shield White House documents from a congressional committee investigating the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. The former president has already appealed the ruling, which was released last night. And the committee is issuing more subpoenas in the investigation, looking to hear from a new set of aides and advisors to Trump about the insurrection. It's the Week in Washington. We'll talk about that and more. And you could join in, as always, at 800-642-1234. Are there questions you still want answered about January 6th and the events at the Capitol? Do you think Trump's advisors should cooperate with congressional investigators? Should Trump be able to keep some of his communications as president leading up to the 6th private? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
We've got this court ruling last night on the House committee's efforts to get some documents from the Trump administration. This is not the end of the line for court challenges. What did the judge say?
So the president, the former president, effectively tried to exert executive privilege after he has left the White House. Now, ordinarily, for most of these things, an incumbent president will extend that executive privilege power or authority to his predecessor. President Biden, though, says that these documents should be turned over to Congress, and the judge sided with President Biden, saying effectively the incumbent president is the one who has authority to safeguard executive privilege rather than his predecessor. The quote that really stood out to me was, "Presidents are not kings and plaintiff is not president." So she ruled that the current president is the one with the authority, and given that Biden supports handing these documents over to Congress, that they should be handed over unless a higher court than her disagrees.
And what's the timeline on that? The former president is taking this to higher courts. When could this whole debate end?
Well, whenever the Supreme Court decides to get involved in this or decides not to get involved, either way. But Biden has ordered that the documents be turned over by Friday unless there is a court injunction. Now, these records are held by the National Archives and Records Administration, which is one of these government agencies that's better known for safeguarding the physical copies of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence than they are for getting involved in court fights.
I want to go listen to Congressman Benny Thompson, Democrat, on the committee, chair of the House Select Committee investigating January 6th, reacting here to the ruling last night on CNN.
You know, we are a nation of laws. So if you take your issue to court and lose, then you need to man up and deal with it and not be a spoiled brat.
What kind of documents do we know, anyway, that Representative Thompson and his colleagues, what are they looking for here?
Well, they're looking for communications between President Trump and a number of his former advisors and allies, both inside and outside the administration, specifically documents about what people are starting to call the command center. This is a group of Trump advisors outside the administration who set up an office at the Willard Intercontinental Hotel. That's right across the street from the White House, where in that sort of bunker for a couple of days leading up to the January 6th insurrection, former Trump advisors like Steve Bannon, Bernie Kerik, the former police commissioner in New York, were overseeing efforts to try to pressure Congress into overturning the legitimate election results of the 2020 elections.
Meanwhile, subpoenas going on, more key figures in the Trump administration there. What are some of the names you're hearing getting subpoenas now from this committee?
So the committee has dramatically expanded the number of people they have subpoenaed searching for information about this, and they fall into a couple of buckets. On one side is the campaign bucket. That includes Bill Stepien, who was Trump's campaign manager in 2020, Jason Miller, who has played a role in Trump's political career, basically going back to 2015. Then the second bucket you'd call sort of the people who were involved in trying to overturn the election results. I mentioned Bernie Kerik, Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, and John Eastman, the attorney who wrote a memo arguing that Vice President Mike Pence had the authority to overturn the election results. Mike Pence disagreed with that interpretation of law and history. And I got to say, pretty much every constitutional scholar in America agrees with Pence on that one. And then the third bucket is people who worked at the White House itself. And these are the people who I think you can start inferring basically that we'll have a pretty strong interest in that court case over presidential executive privilege. There are people like Stephen Miller, the longtime policy advisor, Kayleigh McEnany, the press secretary, and John McEntee, who was the White House personnel director, who we know from some recent reporting from ABC's Jonathan Carl, was pretty involved in trying to make sure that the administration was stocked with people who were loyal to Trump first rather than the country first.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, including the January 6th committee in the House. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah. Good afternoon. You know, you guys in the media and the Democrats are in for a big because the Supreme Court will overrule this. The executive branch has full and equal power to the other two branches in government. And what happened while Trump was president, he does have executive privilege, and this will be overturned by the Supreme Court. So this is not a victory for the Democrats. You'll see.
Jeff, thanks for the call. I wouldn't be surprised either way the Supreme Court ruled on this, Reed. I don't know about you. But that argument that this is an equal branch, Congress doesn't have the ability. How much oversight ability does the Congress have?
Well, the Congress has substantial oversight ability over just about everything in the executive branch, except for communications with the president. Now, what the U.S. District Court judge ruled yesterday was that extends to the president, the current one, not the past one. Again, presidents are not kings, and the plaintiff is not president. So if the incumbent president says that these documents must be turned over, this judge, at least, who is a U.S. District Court judge for the District of Columbia, said that no, that's in fact a decision that the current president, Joe Biden, gets to make. We'll see what the U.S. Supreme Court has to say about this, but this is uncharted legal territory, and I'm not aware, and I haven't in my research in the half hour leading up to coming onto the show, I haven't found anybody who is aware of a time when the Supreme Court ruled on a former president's claim of executive privilege when the current president is willing to override it.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. We'll go now to Jimmy in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon. I just had a question on executive privilege. Can executive privilege shield criminal activity? Because it appears that the committee is looking for some type of conspiracy that went beyond just planning the protest, but actually maybe if some of Trump's advisors or some of these other folks had actually planned attacking the Capitol. And I'll take my answer off there.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. I've seen Reed that argument anyway. Is this something members of this congressional committee are talking about, that executive privilege wouldn't necessarily apply if there was some sort of conspiracy being concealed there?
Well, I can't pretend to be a legal expert on this particular
Same.
Question. What I can tell you is the committee is investigating a few key areas that I think all touch on this particular thing. One is the money. Where did the money come from that funded the groups that organized the protests that led up to the insurrection on January 6th? A second bucket is sort of the planning. How closely was the White House involved in the meetings with those at the Willard and in other meetings that took place at the Trump International Hotel here in Washington, D.C. And then the third thing, and I think that the thing that's going to be hardest for them to answer, is the question of violence. Was anybody in the White House aware of plans to commit violence against Congress that took place on January 6th, or that could have taken place, or plans to commit the violence that did take place against the members of the U.S. Capitol Police and other police services?
Jimmy, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Joe now in Baraboo. Joe, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to say that it seems like the Biden administration and Merrick Garland have been especially restrained through all this, and I think that's to be applauded. However, sometimes I think too restrained, always for fear of something being called political, that their motives are political. Well, this whole thing is political. And I'm very tired of folks saying, well, because it's political, it's bad. That's what our nation is founded on, is the Constitution, which involves politics.
Gotcha, Joe. Thanks a lot for the call. And a lot of eyes on Merrick Garland, Attorney General Reed, on a lot of these issues, including whether he will pursue any action against Steve Bannon for resisting congressional subpoenas.
Right, and Steve Bannon has been held in contempt by Congress. This is now up to the Justice Department to enforce. There have been some calls from Democrats and some Democrats in Congress for Merrick Garland and the current Justice Department to take a harder line against those who were accused of wrongdoing and who have been convicted in the January 6th insurrection. There is growing pressure on the Justice Department to act, and at the same time, there's a cross pressure on the White House to restore the independence, some of which was lost during the Trump administration, of the Justice Department. So this is sort of a no-win situation for the Attorney General, and one that the president is probably hesitant to weigh in on, as he promises a more independent judiciary.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, with us today for a look at the top stories in Washington. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Moving on to infrastructure. Are you celebrating the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure package? Are you worried about more government spending? How about that other spending package on social issues, climate change prevention, and more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Reed Wilson stays with us from The Hill. Infrastructure now on deck is redistricting around the country. Join in with your thoughts or questions about either at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reed, the Congress passed this infrastructure bill, the bipartisan one, the first of two big ones that Democrats are hoping to pass. Signing ceremony, I'm just reading, scheduled now for Monday with President Biden. How big a deal is it that this ended up getting passed?
Well, it's a big deal in a couple of ways. First of all, it's a big deal in that it's the first major investment in infrastructure in decades, and one that is going to send billions of dollars to states across the country. We're already seeing headlines as I sort of do my daily scan of, you know, state X gets, you know, Y billion dollars in money for fixing roads and bridges. It's also a big deal because this vote was a sea change in the way Congress has acted. Usually infrastructure bills are things that everybody wants to vote for because everybody gets a chunk of money for projects in their district. And then Congressman X gets to go to a ribbon cutting and say, hey, look what I delivered to this district. In this time around, though, we saw 19 Republicans vote in favor of it in the U.S. Senate, which is a pretty healthy margin, although not quite what you might have expected in the past. In the House, though, just 13 Republicans voted in favor of it, and almost the majority of those were from New York and New Jersey, two places that are badly in need of infrastructure dollars. So this tells you a little bit that, you know, even something that in the past was a rubber stamp gimme win for every member of Congress has now gotten caught up in the partisan bickering that dominates D.C.
Looking at the political outcome of this, as I mentioned, a signing ceremony coming up. There's been critique from within the Democratic Party, I think, that Democrats don't sell their successes well enough. Do you expect to see some footballs being spiked and champagne being popped?
There's going to be some of that in Washington, but that's less important than the footballs being spiked in, you know, Kenosha and Milwaukee and Green Bay and everywhere else, you know, from coast to coast, as members of Congress talk about what they've brought back to their district. Now, that's going to be important for Democrats to do. And really, they have suffered so much in polling lately, in part because the main story has been about who's bickering with who on Capitol Hill and the legislative sausage making rather than the actual outcomes of the bill. So now that they've got something, you know, a lot of the Democrats I was talking to this week were telling me, all right, we've had our year of debate. Now it's time for a year of action. That's what they hope will rebound them in the minds of voters. You know, I don't recall a rebound of that type going into a midterm election in recent years, but the Democrats certainly have to try.
Let's bring on a caller. Ron is with us in Madison. Ron, hi.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone.
What do you want to bring up?
Mine is, well, I have a question and a comment. The question is, how do we change what I'm going to say? I mean, he's been around the block. He knows the establishment. This is nothing new, but we have an infrastructure bill that contains pork. And while it's nothing new and it's been going on forever, why is there nothing over the years that can be done about taking out the pork? For instance, I noticed the infrastructure bill reported this morning that by 2026, all cars will have to have some sort of driver alert system, either interlock system to report the drivers either under the influence or not under the influence. What does that have to do with infrastructure? Just as a simple example.
Ron, thanks for the call. That would be a traffic safety portion. People are driving on the highways, I guess, intoxicated read. But his wider concerns that pork finds its way into an infrastructure package like this.
Yeah, I mean, the infrastructure package is the ultimate pork product, if you will. But then again, you know, the roads and bridges that are in a congressman's district are the ones that need to be fixed. I mean, those roads and bridges have to be somewhere. And so a lot of this money that goes to individual projects in a congressmember's district is money that those districts need to be fixed. And I'd also bring up the fact that if you take away Congress's power of the purse, their power to direct where that spending goes, then you're basically leaving the decision up to bureaucrats in the Department of Transportation building here in Washington, D.C. Now, do you really want that, or do you want your member of Congress to direct, you know, X million dollars to go fix that bridge over there?
Thanks for the call, Ron, at 800-642-1234. Reid, now Democrats looking at the apparently harder to pass piece of legislation. They won't get Republican support, or very little, if any, on the other one, the social safety net spending, climate change, and more. Where is that right now?
Right. They're not going to get any Republican votes on this. And basically, they're all waiting to figure out if they get the votes of five moderates in the House of Representatives and one moderate, Senator Joe Manchin, in the U.S. Senate. Those moderates are waiting for a score, a sort of basically a fiscal note from the Congressional Budget Office, which produces sort of cost estimates for how much these things are going to add to the deficit. Now, the CBO has said that they're going to take, they have to take a few days to get some of this out. But the moderates promised when the infrastructure bill passed that they would vote for it by at least by the latest next week. So we'll see when Congress comes back whether or not they have a sufficient score from the CBO. Basically, they're hoping that what the White House says, that this bill will pay for itself, will prove to be true, according to the nonpartisan arbiters over at the CBO.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national news. Reed, I know you're watching redistricting around the country. It's going on here in Wisconsin and, of course, everywhere. What are some of the states you have your eyes on right now?
This is my favorite thing to talk about every decade. I mean, this is an amazingly political process that's playing out in states like Wisconsin right now, where the governor's either threatened to or already has vetoed the district lines that state legislative Republicans had passed. Right now, we know the contours, the basic outlines of the districts in about half the states, but we're waiting for the big states like California to finalize their map, Florida, where Republicans just put out a draft map that I'm still going through the numbers here, but it looks only marginally good for them. The bottom line here that I'd say is Republicans have basically drawn themselves into a position where if the elections were held in last year's atmosphere, in the 2020 environment, Republicans would reclaim control of Congress by at least a few seats. But of course, we're not going to run the midterm elections in last year's environment. Right now, the environment looks worse for Democrats, so they could be looking at a real catastrophe here coming towards the midterms if they don't dramatically turn things around. Now, what could turn things around? The infrastructure bill, the reconciliation package, and a booming economy, and maybe this inflation surge dies down and people start feeling better about the economy. Is that going to happen? Not entirely certain it will. History does not argue for a president's party. Only twice in the last century has a first-term president picked up seats in the U.S. House of Representatives in their first midterm election.
Some states, the process is controlled by Democrats and they're drawing Democratic-friendly maps. Some states, it's Republicans. Some have a neutral or a nonpartisan effort to do it. All told, who has a better playing field in terms of control of this process in various states, Reid?
Well, right now, Republicans control about twice as many U.S. House seats, control the map lines for twice as many U.S. House seats as do Democrats. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to draw twice as many seats, twice as many Republican seats as the Dems are. For example, take a state like Alabama, where there are seven districts. Right now, there are six Republicans and one Democrat. Well, they just drew district lines that are going to have six Republicans and one Democrat. So there's not really a bunch of change there. If Wisconsin changes, it's probably going to change by only one seat. Retiring Congressman Ron Kind's seat seems to be in the crosshairs of the debate right now. And, you know, in some other places where Republicans have all the control, you know, a state like West Virginia, they're actually going to lose a seat because the delegation shrinks by one. So it's very complex math, and we haven't seen the end of this yet. And let me tell you, every time a state passes their final maps, the other party is taking them straight to court. So this is going to be a very good decade for election lawyers. And any law students who are listening, let me tell you, go into that election law field. That is a growth industry right now.
Lots of money to be made once every 10 years. Reed, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, man.
That's Reed Wilson. He's a national correspondent at The Hill. He was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, after an upset win in the Virginia governor's race, national Republicans say they'll focus on parents' frustrations with schools and education. We'll talk to an expert on education politics about the forces behind the renewed attention and what it means for elections and for kids' education. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.